From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line for you at 1-800-462-7413. And of course, along with your calls, Zorba brings some interesting topics in to talk about.
Yes, rats. They can be bred to exercise or not to exercise. We'll talk about that. And what does that say about us humans and whether or not we can do that?
Okay, and?
Walnuts for diabetes. Maybe we've got the answer to the diabetes epidemic.
Sounds like a good one. What's our recipe?
Apple pie waffles. Doesn't that sound good? Apple pie.
Sounds great.
Waffles and maple syrup.
I bet we could throw some walnuts in if we
had. I bet we could too, Tom. That'd be a great idea.
1-800-462-7413. And to the phones we go now, Zorba. We welcome our first caller, a listener in Honolulu, Hawaii. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
How can we help?
I was actually curious to find out what Zorba's take on phytonutrients are, actually. I've been eating a lot of legumes as well as taro, which is kind of a more traditional staple here in Hawaii. But someone actually told me that they're high in phytates and oxalates, and they can actually be really harmful.
Mm-hmm. Well, taro, so you like the taste of taro, right?
I do like the taste of taro, not... It depends on the preparation, but I do eat it on occasion.
Yeah, you know, it's something that one gets used to. I've been to Hawaii a number of times, mm-hmm. and I've had taro each time, and there are differences in how they're prepared. It's sort of a native – it's a native root that has been there forever. I love phyto. Phyto nutrients are very, very important, and it's quite interesting. And if we look at sort of where science has come down on this, we've taken things out of fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. So we've taken beta-carotene out and said, well, beta-carotene must produce longevity because beta-carotene is what we find, for instance, in broccoli and cruciferous vegetables. And we know that people eat a lot of it, have less cancer. And so when we took it out and did a study, the study turned out to be a dud called the carrot study. And in fact, it actually increased the amount of cancer in smokers. So beta-carotene bit the dust. Vitamin E bit the dust. A number of things that get manufactured bit the dust. Now, it's still a $5 to $10 billion industry, the supplement industry, but it turns out that Mother Nature does something else. So when you look at phytoestrogens, phytonutrients, minerals, there are other things that must be in the vegetable or in the fruit that activate or deactivate certain enzymes, that's my theory, in our body to make them very, very useful. So the variety, I think, is your best insurance to actually, if you will, get the bounty that Mother Nature has. The other thing is there may be difference in climates in what we actually need. So, for instance, in the northern climate of Wisconsin, there may be certain things that we eat that are more important to us mm-hmm. than in the tropical climate of Hawaii. And there may be some advantages to eating taro in Hawaii that may not confer advantages to us in northern Wisconsin because we co-evolved with plants, just like we co-evolved with dogs. They became part of us and we became part of them. We clearly co-evolved with plants. Plants then, if you will, started to change so that we would start to then produce them so that we would eat them. And we, vice versa, ate the plants that were nutritious for us. And taro has been around in Hawaii for tens of thousands of years.
Do you cook your own food?
I'm actually a cook, actually. I cook at a hotel in Waikiki, actually.
Oh. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but just the fact that you're in Hawaii means that you're going to live a long, long time, doesn't it?
I'm actually a transplant, I've actually been doing a lot of exercise, and that's where I got on the issue of phytonutrients, because I was trying out a paleo diet, mm-hmm, which has kind of become mm-hmm. the new fad diet, and it actually says you're not allowed to eat any legumes. Uh-huh. And other things that contain phytonutrients, mm-hmm. and that's where I got the issue with being able to eat a lot of them.
Uh-huh. You know, you bring up a really good point. When you said diet and fad together, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
And when diets start to limit you from things, I immediately get worried about it. And there was a diet very popular in the 70s by a guy named Seiji Ozawa, the macrobiotic diet. And when people attended to that, they started to get scurvy. scurvy, which we hadn't seen in this country for, you know, 100 years. And like you say, here you have the paleo diet, and it says you shouldn't eat legumes. And it turns out that legumes are incredibly important. It's the paleo diet is a fad, and you need phytonutrients. There's no doubt about it. So, well, thank you. Thanks for sending us some warm Hawaii breezes, right? That's what we need.
We appreciate the call. Was I wrong? I think I heard that Hawaii has the longest lifespan of any other.
Well, no, you're not wrong at all. And there are issues about that. It may be the lifestyle. It may be the Filipino and Japanese and Spanish extractions that are there. Mm-hmm. But they tend to have the greatest longevity. And they don't necessarily – they aren't the wealthiest people, because everything in Hawaii is really, really expensive. It has to be shipped there, except for things like taro. So it certainly is not a money issue. And the satisfaction of life in Hawaii is also very high. So
I wonder
what
why that
are we doing here?
800-462-7413. It's toll-free. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, to Chicago, Illinois we go. Hi.
Hello, Zorba. I'm a big fan. And when I had a question about a product that's an F21 sugar blocker, you were the first person I thought about to see if you were familiar with it, if you knew anything about the science behind it.
Uh-huh. Well, tell me a little bit about it. I've heard of it, but I haven't looked at it scientifically. There's a lot of pseudoscience around where people give the umbrella of science, like they'll say, well, a study shows, and it turns out it's a study that they paid for shows that. So what's it supposed to do?
Well, it is supposed to block sucrose, and at the same time inhibit fat absorption. It is, it looks like it is some kind of an artificial sweetener at its base.
Well, first of all, if we blocked sugar so we couldn't absorb sugar, totally, if we blocked sugar, we would die, because we actually need sugar. That's
exactly
the main. I mean, there's no way. We'd be that. You take this thing, it would be a poison, you know?
Well, I do have people around me, not myself,
who are
taking this, because it kind of gives you the promise of, hey, you can keep drinking your, you know, your soft drink.
Right,
and you're eating your candy every day, and all you have to do is pop a few of these beforehand, and you'll be fine. And I just, it really makes me nervous.
Of course it does.
Even anyone I know is taking this.
Of course it does. Here it is, you know, block your sugar. You don't have any energy. You won't have energy in your brain. You're faint, you die. It's not going to do anything. And here it is, you're able to eat your liquid calories. I mean, think about it. You know, they're liquid calories. 12 ounces or 20 ounces of Coke, you know, is equivalent to a Snickers, roughly. It's somewhere in that range. So here it is. What you're basically having are liquid Snickers when you're drinking soda. And when you put it in that realm, your brain goes in liquid Snickers, you know, because we know what everyone knows what a Snickers bar is. No, the fat blockers are just another sham quack sale. That's what they sound like, to supposedly allow you to eat calories and not put them on. But these fat blockers, it reminds me of that famous phrase of Lincoln, you can fool some of the people some of the time. What is it you can fool?
Some of the people some all of the time, all of the people some of the time.
But you can't fool all of the people
all
of
the time.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So we're not the fools. So what are you going to tell your friends?
Well, I am going to tell them to just don't drink the soda. I say, eat organic foods, exercise every day.
Right.
Sir, listen to Zorba. Right. I mean, these are, you know, just follow these basic 5 rules.
I like to listen to the Zorba. Listen to the show and you will lose weight. That's what we're going to change the name to. Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Listen to the show and lose pounds as you listen.
There you go.
And if you're on the treadmill while you're listening to the show, hey, maybe it'll work.
Well, I was hoping that somebody who was considering taking this might hear your show and, you know, pay attention to what you're saying. So
I appreciate you
taking the call.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, to Oakland, California. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. What's up?
Well, I'm calling because I have genetically high cholesterol that I inherited from my mother, and I was wondering what's a more natural way to deal with that issue.
Mm-hmm. What is your cholesterol?
I haven't had it checked in a long time, but I know when I was working out a lot, the lowest it got to was 213.
Mm-hmm. 213. Well, that's not too bad, actually. There's some people with genetically high cholesterol, and their lowest number is 400. Mm-hmm. And those are very, you know, those are often people. Some of them have heart attacks at a very low.
Well, 260 is high, though.
Yeah, but 400 is even higher than 260. Yeah, yeah. That's it. How old are you?
I'm 25.
25. And mom, dad, heart disease in the family? Tell me a little bit about it.
No one in my family has died from a heart attack, but my mom's side has a history of cancer.
Uh-huh. So here it is. We have a high cholesterol, but we don't have a history of heart attacks. Very important point there. Because if you have heart attacks in your 30s or 40s, that's the real issue, you know, especially before the age of 50. That's kind of one of the markers that we use. What's your good cholesterol? What's your HDL? What's the good stuff?
I want to say it's about 100.
Well, if your good cholesterol is 100, let's talk a little bit about it. Total cholesterol has some meaning, but it doesn't have a lot of meaning. We've got to look at the LDL, the bad cholesterol, and the HDL, the good cholesterol. And remember that the way I used to remember it is the LDL, or the low-density lipoproteins, will put you under the ground, and the HDL, or the high-density lipoproteins, will keep you above the ground so you'll live. Now, if you've got a cholesterol of 260 or 270, but you've got a super high HDL of 80 or 100, and there's some people who have it, you don't have a cholesterol problem. People would kill for that cholesterol. Mm-hmm. I'd go back to your doc, at least I'd call up and I'd say, what's my HDL? And if your HDL is 100, you are super fine and you don't have to do anything other than what we all should do to stay well.
Okay, I'll go back and get my cholesterol double checked.
And give us a call back. I'd like to know what that HDL and what the LDL cholesterol. Give us a call back and we'll continue this conversation either on the radio or on our website, zorbapastor.org. If you go back, give Gabby, our producer, the numbers, then we'll continue this and we'll finish this out.
That sounds great. I'll do that.
Thanks a lot.
Great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. So, Zorba, we have a rat study to talk about.
Yes, I love rats. Do you love rats?
Oh, doesn't everybody?
Everyone loves rats. Moving on to the actual study, it turns out that you can breed rats to exercise. You can breed them to exercise. This was a study where they took rats, they had a bunch of rats, and they put wheels in cages and then monitored how much mileage were on the wheels. They had male and female rats, and when they had a male that liked to do more exercise and a female that liked to do more exercise, they bred them together, and they ended up getting baby rats, and then they looked at the ones who wanted to do more exercise. And didn't want to do more exercise. And several generations, lo and behold, you have rats that love to be on the treadmill.
So
they just get up in the morning and they just want to go, go, go on the treadmill.
So if you don't exercise, you can blame your parents.
Absolutely. There is no doubt about it. That's what this study shows. The study shows it's all in the genes. If you don't exercise, blame your parents and simply forget about it. Don't even try. But it is kind of interesting because it shows, just like everything else we have, there probably is a genetic and a learned component. And so in the genetic component, people who exercise often have children who exercise, and people who don't exercise often have children who don't exercise. Now, I want to give you one good exception to that rule. Me, moi. Penny and I were non-exercisers. Now, I've started exercise, but I've got to push myself to exercise. It's not my favorite thing. I have four children who exercise all the time.
Really?
My oldest son, Zach, called me the other day, and he said, I've been playing soccer in the Booz Allen Soccer League. He works for a company called Booz Allen in Washington, D.C. My daughter, Vanessa, plays soccer in a pickup league in law school in Milwaukee. My daughter, Didi, is playing soccer and does marathons in Washington, D.C. And my son Eli loves to do marathons in Boston. And Penny and I love to sit on the couch. We are natively couch potatoes. We have to push ourselves to get out. So I'm not sure this rat study really applies to humans, but you can blame it on the parents.
It's fun anyway.
Yes, it is.
800-462-7413 to Black Earth, Wisconsin now, Zorba. Hi.
Hi, Tom and Zorba.
What's up?
I recently heard about a procedure called delayed cord clamping, and I heard about it when I was pregnant with my second child and decided to ask my OB if she minded doing it, and we did.
Good. there's some interesting things with this. So we're talking
about
the placenta when the baby is born. Baby is born, comes out, and it's attached to the placenta through the cord. Mm-hmm. How long did you delay it before you clamped the cord?
Honestly, everything happened so fast.
It does, doesn't it?
I don't remember.
That's right. It does. But usually there's a little amnesia that comes after that baby comes out, right. And it's a lot of work that moms have to do. But back in the 60s, what they did was they did the opposite. They would massage the cord and so that the babies would have more blood in them. And then they did a study, and they found out that wasn't very good. In fact, they discovered that what they were doing is the babies had too much blood in them. They were much more likely to be jaundiced, and they had problems. So then they went to the opposite realm, mm-hmm. where they said, okay, we've got to clamp the cord right away, get it out, clamp the cord. And in fact, after the baby was born, they'd give a shot of Pitocin to get the placenta out of the womb right away. Well, then that had side effects. Some of the babies were anemic because they would clamp the cord sort of instantly and not wait at all. Some parents thought, well, maybe this isn't good. Some other people thought maybe we should let it stay a little bit longer. And now there's a movement more towards delaying the cord clamping for a while, and a while meaning a minute or 2 minutes or sometimes even 5 or 10 minutes or longer. And the cord naturally sort of clamps down on itself. You still have to cut it and clamp it, but the blood between the fetal blood that's in the placenta doesn't flow into the baby forever. Eventually, a certain amount flows. So, and that's kind of where things are at now. Babies are put on the mom's chest if there's nothing wrong to suckle, and then the cord is left for a while.
So, right. I just know that they said they waited until it stopped pulsating.
Yeah, and that's sort of what it is right now. And that's obviously it seems like a much more natural way to do things. And in fact, it is, and it shows you how much we interfere with natural childbirth because we worry about, we'll say, the 5% or 10% who have problems. And so what happens is for the 90%, we start treating the 90% like the 10%, and we should not do that. How old is your baby?
She's almost 5 weeks.
Almost 5 weeks. Boy or a girl?
A girl, and okay. We have a 3-year-old son.
Oh, how wonderful! What's he think? What's your 3-year-old son think of the new kid in the house?
He loves her.
Oh, how
it's
neat!
It's really pretty sweet.
How
he
neat!
He just doesn't want to go to daycare anymore.
He doesn't want to go to daycare anymore. He wants to be with his little sibling. How wonderful! That is so important, and so important when you have, when you have a new child in the house, to really incorporate all the kids into everything you have to do: fixing the baby, changing the diapers, breastfeeding, all the other stuff. So you're breastfeeding your baby?
Yes, that's going very well.
Yeah, that is wonderful. Well, breast is best. That breast is best, absolutely. So, well, thank you for your call, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
What a feel-good show we have.
What a feel-good show. Well, wait a minute. From rats on the treadmill to new boards and cord clamping, you can find it all here, even tarot.
Before we take a short break, Zorba, time now for you to give out a bit of 4-cent advice. Bob in Wisconsin has an issue for you to chew over. He writes, "Dear Dr. Pastor, I am a former user of chewing tobacco. 7 years ago, when I was in my mid-30s, my dentist referred me to an oral surgeon. The oral surgeon said, and this is almost verbatim, that I should not worry about it. I told my dentist, and she couldn't believe this. She even made me call the surgeon while I was there in the dentist chair, but he repeated the same advice. I've quit chewing and have no intention of restarting, but I really want to know, what is your opinion of chewing tobacco?"
Oh, it's absolute junk. In fact, I'm going to take my little gavel, which I love to use, and I'm going to go bang. Oral surgeon 0, dentist right. I can just picture, though, you're sitting in the chair. The dentist is working in your mouth.
Yeah.
You're discussing things, and you're saying, okay, the tobacco's all right. And so the dentist then pulls out the cell phone and say, wait a second, I'm going to put down the drill. You call up the oral surgeon. I want to see whether or not that oral surgeon is right. They're completely wrong. You know, tobacco is awful. It's bad. It causes cancer of the lips, cancer of, Roger Ebert, died of an oral pharyngeal cancer. I have no idea if it was related to tobacco or tobacco products.
No.
You know, it's an awful death, and the oral surgeon was wrong. And I hate to say it, but I'm going to say it. How stupid can that oral surgeon be?
Maybe you don't trust a surgeon who is right there to take your call when you're sitting in the dentist
well,
chair.
Well, that is true.
Not
that
doing
is
anything
true.
Important.
With the drill.
Hi,
with
Fred.
With the drill. With the drill.
Wait,
you
just sitting
it.
Around reading a magazine.
You've got
no,
it.
No, go ahead and chew. It's
That's
fine.
Right. You've got it. You've got it. That's exactly it. That's exactly
Are your docs in a duel? Let Zorba set them straight. Just send your debates along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Guess what we have for you? A recipe coming up, a good one, too. More of your calls, of course. Some more research to talk over. Our medical myth buster. The list goes on here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. The toll-free number, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, apple pie waffles.
You love it. Do you love waffles?
Yeah, okay. I mean, love is too strong a word.
I love waffles.
I like
but I don't make them very often.
I haven't had a waffle in years, so I guess I don't love them.
You have not had a waffle in years?
No.
Really? You have been deprived. You don't have a waffle iron in the house?
No. Yeah, right.
You caught that, didn't you? Yeah. You like that?
We have a stove.
Modern, aren't you?
Yeah.
It's not a wood-burning stove.
No,
right?
No.
It's connected to gas. Well, I always think of waffles as a celebration. I don't get up on a Sunday and just make waffles for Penny and I.
Right.
I mean, but I think of it as something like, you know, when somebody comes over, I make waffles. And I've always had a waffle iron. I've got a wonderful waffle iron, and I love making waffles. And they're fluffier and more delicious than you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Have I motivated you to buy a waffle
yeah,
iron?
Yeah, my mouth is watering. Listen.
But no waffle iron. You're not going to
oh,
buy
no,
it.
Oh, no, of course not.
Not that much. Okay, 1 3/4 cup of whole wheat pastry flour.
1 3/4 cups of whole wheat pastry flour.
So notice we're trying to make the waffle a little bit healthier. Now, it's not as if this is going to make it a lot healthier. It's still a waffle. But anything you can do, these little bits that you can do to change a recipe to make it healthier, and there are a few other things in here we'll talk about.
Okay.
One thing in specific is going to make a difference. Now, flour is made in a different way. And a pastry flour is a lighter, fluffier flour. If you ever use pastry flour, and I know, Tom, you use it when you make chocolate chip cookies,
right.
it's sort of dusty and it gets into the environment.
So they have this whole wheat pastry flour.
Right.
Too.
And so you may have to go to a specialty area of the store to get that. And if you can't, I would use, you know, white pastry flour, but whole wheat is better. 4 teaspoons of Truvia.
What's Truvia?
Well, Truvia is a natural sweetener that has no calories. It contains stevia. And so it's a natural sweetener that has no calories.
Okay.
That's now become much more popular. 1 teaspoon of baking powder.
Little tea baking powder.
1/2 teaspoon of baking soda.
Half a little tea baking soda.
1 1/2 teaspoons of cinnamon.
1 1/2 little tea cinnamon.
Now, Tom, I know when you shop, sometimes you get those large containers of cinnamon because you use it in everything.
Actually, I do get cinnamon.
You do.
And I do the small one because I listen to you.
Yeah, because it'll stay fresher.
Yeah.
What do you use the cinnamon in? Like cinnamon and sugar?
I don't know.
On toast?
Put it in the cupboard, and my wife uses it. For something.
Your wife uses it. That's right. She uses. You buy it. She uses.
You got it.
Cinnamon. 1/4 teaspoon of nutmeg.
1/4 little tea nutmeg.
Now, if you want a really good taste, you buy nutmeg. They look like acorns, and what you do is you grate them, and you grate the nutmeg, and it stays much fresher. And as soon as you use a nutmeg that you grate, you will never go to dried nutmeg.
That much better.
No comparison.
Okay.
And the nutmeg's the actual kind of acorn-looking nuts. nuts. They must be a nut. Nutmeg. Mm-hmm. Duh. Must be a nut. Actually lasts for a long, long time, and you grate them fresh. Eighth of a teaspoon of ground cloves.
Eighth little tea ground cloves.
If you don't like cloves, don't use it.
Right.
A quarter teaspoon ground ginger.
Quarter little tea ground ginger.
And you've got to use dry ginger. And once again, you can see these are aromatics that are in there.
Mm-hmm.
A quarter teaspoon of salt.
Quarter little tea salt.
Half teaspoon of vanilla.
Half a little tea vanilla.
Now, there is nothing compared to homemade vanilla. It is the most aromatic vanilla. I have never purchased vanilla that's that good. I love Penzi spices. I've gotten their double strength vanilla, but you can make your own vanilla at home, and it's about a tenth of the price.
Hmm.
And we'll do that sometime. Half a cup of applesauce.
Half a cup of applesauce.
1 3/4 cup of skim milk.
1 3/4 of a cup of skim milk.
Yeah, and if you want to use 1 or 2%, that would be okay too.
Yeah.
4 large egg whites.
4 large egg whites.
And cooking spray.
I got to ask you, we have all these little teaspoons mm-hmm. and half teaspoons. Yeah. Does that stuff really show up in such small amounts?
First of all, it does show up if you can smell. Can you smell?
Not as well as I used to.
Well, so for you, it may not show up, but that's a serious issue. When you're younger, the aromatics mean more because our sense of smell is good.
Yeah.
I used to be able to walk into the woods and I would smell the pine trees and they would knock me over.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I walk into the woods and I have to go to put my nose in the pine tree to smell it because my sense of smell isn't as good and your sense of taste isn't as good. Mm-hmm. So, yes, these aromatics will knock you over. And for many of us, we actually have these in our shelf. I mean, I've got all this stuff. I wouldn't have to shop for any of this.
Yeah.
And I use it in things like this. Okay. Are we ready?
We are.
Okay. Preheat the oven to 250 degrees, and that's to keep your waffles warm. And then you've got to preheat the waffle maker. And I've got a couple suggestions about the waffle maker. Preheat it early, because what happens is if you put the waffles in and it's not heated up and you're too excited and you want to put it in, they will stick. The second thing I recommend is take newspaper. Does anyone still buy newspapers?
Sure.
I do.
I do.
And put it underneath the waffle maker, and then the cleanup is easy. And what you do is you just put it all underneath, and because it always gets all over the counter, and I hate cleaning it up. All you do is fold up the newspaper and put it in the garbage. I highly recommend that. Mm-hmm. You will be happy. And in the case in my house, it makes my wife happy. And if she, who must be obeyed, is happy, I am happy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Take all the dry ingredients. I'm not going to list them, but the flour, the Truvia, baking powder, and so on. Take all the dry ingredients, whisk them to combine them. So combine them with a spoon, or if you have a whisk, whisk them around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a separate bowl, you're going to combine the wet ingredients, the vanilla, applesauce, and milk, not the egg whites, okay? Now, slowly whisk the wet ingredients into the dry ingredients. You've got to pour wet into dry just until they're combined. Do not overmix. If you overmix, your waffle will not taste is good. It's got to be lumpy. Strange as it may seem, it's got to be lumpy or it won't work. Now, in another bowl, whisk the egg whites until they form stiff peaks. And you've got to do that. I use an egg beater to do that. And then gently fold the egg whites into the waffle mix. And it's going to look very aerated and very gently. As soon as it's folded in, leave it. Don't overmix it or you're going to get rid of the air that you need to do. Then spray the waffle maker with nonstick cooking spray. It's better than oil. Put it in the batter, leave it on until my waffle maker turns green when the waffle is done, when the heat goes up. Serve it, sprinkle the cinnamon, and maybe put some little roasted apple slices on top of it or a little dab of applesauce, and you've got a wonderful apple pie waffles.
Maybe some maple syrup.
Little maple syrup on top of it would be really good. Then a nice fresh cup of coffee and some good conversation, and you've got heaven, a 10 on the scale of 1 to 10.
And anyone who'd like this recipe can
come to our website at zorbapastor.org, and guess what? You can see Tom's picture. You can see my picture. You can download this recipe. You can download other recipes. You can sign up for a podcast. You can win the lottery for $10 million if we had it on there, but we don't. And remember that, zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, find us on Facebook. You can even friend us. You can like us. You can do whatever you want to, because Facebook is fun.
800-462-7413. Toll free. 1-800-462-7413. To the phones now, Zorba, a listener with us in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, this is Keenan.
Yeah, how can we help, Keenan?
I have a question regarding negative heart effects from long-term exercise. I've been doing endurance sports for a few years now. It's my hobby, and I'm currently training for my first Ironman. And I've been reading recently that long-term endurance athletes can develop heart problems from excessive exercise. Are there tests I can do that can reduce this risk? Should I find a new hobby? Is there any truth to this?
I don't think I'd find a new hobby. You know, that, you know, it's kind of interesting. For years, there's a whole school that believes that we have a limited number of heartbeats in our life. And if we, I could just see Tom's eyes. He just rolled his eyes. And the reason why people who exercise live longer is because it reduces the number of heartbeats per minute. You know, and we're programmed to have like, you know, 1 million, 10 million, 30 million heartbeats. And once we reach that number, our heart stops and we die. And there's a counter in the heart somewhere. No one has found it that counts those heartbeats. But I kid you not, this is a school of thought. It's actually a school of yogic thought that's out there. If you do the math, it turns out that people who exercise live longer. They have less disability and they live longer. Now, the aerobic jogging lobby, which I used to be a member of, I'm no longer a card-carrying member of the jogging lobby, used to say you've got to exercise for 20 minutes a day, 3 days a week in order to get the benefits of exercise and you'll live a lot longer. And it turns out that pretty much a baby aspirin does the same thing. You know, so if you sit on the couch and take a baby aspirin, you'll live about just as long as if you get out and exercise with that. But aerobic exercise and getting your body to move has other benefits. Reduces the risk of diabetes, still reduces the risk. You're actually going to have a fatal heart attack. It's got some other benefits, too. So there's nothing at all to the concept that you are doing your heart harm. Where have you read this? What sort of places have you looked at on the web or in magazines?
There's a... what's it called? A TED talk from a cardiologist who kind of talked about a dose dependence that you do too much, it becomes unhealthy. Some of the forums that I've read on the internet advise that maybe you should get some sort of, you know, EKG or an echocardiogram periodically to check for. I'm not sure what the problem is.
Well, it's kind of interesting. TED Talks are great. And so they have the, if you will, they have the aura of they must be right because they're very organized. They're X number of minutes. You can look it up on the computers and it can be someone, somebody. Often these are people who are very expert in their fields and they talk about it within a defined period of time. So you are given, we'll say it's 14 minutes. I don't know the exact time. And their information and their education and they're really good and they're dynamite. But they're not all real. So here you have a cardiologist and a highly produced, you can look at it, you can write TED Talk cardiologist heart problems and it'll probably pop up. And a cardiologist on the stage in front of other people talking about how this may be bad for the heart. Now, this is an opinion that this cardiologist may have, and then it spurs a whole lot of discussion on the internet. That's really what they do. So getting back to the issue, for a long time, we used to say, before you exercise, go get a treadmill at your doctor. And then studies were done that showed this was not only a waste of time, but we were picking up abnormalities on the stress test that turned out not to lead to anything, and it led to echocardiograms and catheterizations that were unnecessary. And for every catheterization, you run a risk. So now the whole idea is not to exercise people unless there's a reason. In other words, they have bad high blood pressure or something else that's going on. So I do not recommend you have a stress test before it. I do not recommend an echocardiogram. I think train for your Ironman. And my big recommendation is take that TED Talk on your computer and hit delete.
Will do.
And good luck. Hope you do a great time.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure, we appreciate the call. And before another short break, Zorba, time for you to grab that gavel for a case of Judge Zorba.
Okay, I've got the gavel. It's in my hand, and I'm holding it the right way as gavels should be held. Okay.
John needs you to clean up a disagreement he's having with his wife. He writes, "Dear Zorba, my wife has been making homemade laundry detergent lately, and frankly, I don't love it. Maybe it's all in my head, but the whites just don't seem as white, the clothes aren't as clean, and sometimes they still even have some odor. I suppose I can live with it, but is it worth it? Are there really added health benefits to using homemade detergent?
Well, there are some health benefits for having clean clothes, but when we think about it, it's really the bacteria on the clothes, the dirt that are on the clothes, and other things. And whether or not they smell a bit probably will not make a difference in terms of your health benefits. So from a health benefit point of view, I don't think it really matters if you have homemade detergent. Now, from the aesthetic point of view, cleaner looking clothes, things like that. I spent a month in Nepal, and because during that month we had no access for the most part for clean clothes, you could try to wash in a little basin that we were given every morning on the trip. And I got used to having clothes that were not particularly clean, and I wasn't particularly clean, but when I finally got to, quote, civilization, first thing I did was wash my clothes and clean up. So aesthetically, it's what you like.
Now, Judge, you must come down with a decision.
I come down, I have to come down with a decision. Husband is white, cleaner clothes, back to the detergents.
Do you have some dirty laundry to air? Just send your couple's complaints along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some interesting research to talk over. We have more of your calls, of course, in our Medical Myth Buster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. But now, before our next call, we talk about some research. Walnuts for diabetes, Zorba?
Yeah, very interesting research. First of all, I mean, let's look at diabetes. Diabetes is on the rise. We don't know why. There are about 25 million Americans who now have diabetes. It's on the rise tremendously. Mm-hmm. And we blame it on lack of exercise and obesity. But it may not just be lack of exercise and obesity. It may be what we're eating, when we're eating it. There may be other issues that are involved with this. And this particular study looked at walnuts. Now, we've known for a while, there are other studies that have shown that tree nuts, so we're not talking about peanuts, which are legumes. We'll put them off to the side. Tree nuts, walnuts, pistachios, cashews, tree nuts do have some benefits. They tend to have omega-3 fatty acids, just like fish, and they may be, you know, they may have some useful benefits. So this was a study, the Nurses' Health Study. Now, the Nurses' Health Study is a large women's health study. Started with 138,000 women they've been looking at over a period of years, starting in 1999. And they looked at walnut consumption. Now, how do you gather walnut consumption? Who pays attention to walnuts, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're asked, how many walnuts do you eat in a month? Well, I wouldn't know my answer.
And this was not a controlled study.
No. It's called an observational study. Yeah. Leads us to some information. Lots of observational studies are junk in the end. They're not real. Mm-hmm. But they give us an idea of what's going on, and then we look and see why. So in this particular study, they said, you know, how often do you eat nuts and what kind of nuts do you eat? And people who eat walnuts, I think, would say, yes, I eat walnuts.
Sure.
Now, what kind of nuts do you eat? Do you eat nuts?
I kind of on and off.
I used to eat nuts all the time.
And I mix nuts
if I have nuts.
Yeah, me too.
So I would say mixed nuts. And what are mixed nuts? Well, I don't know. They're peanuts and cashews and walnuts. But they looked at women who ate walnuts, and they basically found that women who consumed 8 ounces of walnuts a month, okay? So 8 ounces of walnuts are not a lot of walnuts. They're like, you know, I don't know how many handfuls are 8 ounces, but probably a cup or two of walnuts a month. Lowered the risk of type 2 diabetes by 24%.
Wow.
That is an enormous lowering of risk. Now they looked and they controlled for other factors. So they controlled for obesity. They found, first of all, that a lot of women who ate nuts tended to exercise more. But when after controlling for a number of these factors, it still appeared that walnuts in and of themselves may reduce the risk of diabetes. That is rather interesting.
Very interesting.
Very interesting. Now, the more and more we look at nuts, the more and more we see that nuts are beneficial. And the Mediterranean Mediterranean diet that we talked about recently had nuts that you should be eating. So I think walnuts are a nut that you should add to your diet. I think the more nuts that we eat, the better off we are. And a variety of nuts are the way to go. And that's what this really shows. It shows that you should be nuts about nuts.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Oakton, Virginia. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I have a very unique issue. I'm a runner, but when I run outside, if I haven't run in over a week, after about 2 miles, I start getting very dizzy. And then I get to the point where I can't even walk a straight line. The whole world is turning, and then I throw up. And then I'm fine.
Huh. Well, how long
it doesn't happen to me when I am on a treadmill. I can swim. I can bike. I can read in a car. It only seems to be when I run.
Huh. How long has this been going on?
About 14 years.
Oh, my.
Uh-huh. I've been to lots of doctors. I always assumed it was some sort of inner ear balance problem.
Mm-hmm.
My mother has Meniere's disease,
mm-hmm.
And I've been assured that's not related at all.
No, you would know if you had Meniere's disease. No.
And what one doctor was determined it was allergies.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a year showing up his office once a week and getting allergy shots.
Oh, you've really been working on this.
I went to Johns Hopkins and had, tests done there. Yeah. And that doctor, the last time I had it checked out. It was probably 2 years ago.
Uh-huh. What did they say at Hopkins?
He decided it was not an inner ear problem, that it was a strange version of a sports migraine.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. Sports migraine, migraine headaches. Uh-huh. Did they do something called a tilt table test, by the way?
You know, I wish I knew. I think I've had the whole battery of inner ear problems.
The tilt table test is where they put you on a table, and then they tilt you down, and they look at your heart rate. It's looking specifically at a heart rate. And you would know it because you're on what's like an inversion table, and you would know if you had that done.
Yeah, they didn't do that one.
Okay. Well, I've got a couple suggestions. First of all, my first suggestion is get a tilt table test. And the reason is a tilt table test can sometimes pick up whether or not you're having, if you will, overvagal stimulation that is producing a slow heart rate when you should have a fast heart rate. That's what I think is going on. I think your vagus nerve, which controls your heart rate, for some reason when you're running, and we'll talk about that for just a second. And once again, it's all provocative thoughts in my mind of what I would put this together. Your vagal nerve gets overstimulated. You want to vomit. You want to puke. And your heart rate slows down too much and you become dizzy. And this is overactivation of the vagal nerve. That's what would make sense to me, because that's what the vagus nerve does. When we are sick and we vomit and all of a sudden we feel faint, it's overactivation of the vagal nerve. The vagal nerve does lots of stuff in the body. If you go and Google vagal nerve, you'll see what it does. Lots of things. It's very important. And it's also somewhat over conscious. We have the ability to consciously change the vagal nerve, because we do that. If we see something that makes us feel like we're faint, we become faint because we activate the vagal nerve. So some people look at blood and they feel faint. They've activated the vagal nerve. Now, the tilt table test, there's some people that have an adverse reaction and their heart rate should speed up and it doesn't and it slows down. And the treatment for that actually is something called a beta blocker, which slows the heart but turns out to block the effects of this sort of vagal stimulation that occurs. And that's one test that you may talk about, because you'd like to know whether or not that's what's going on. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So that's a test I'd recommend you get done that you doesn't sound like you had done. Cardiologists do this test. Talk to your doc. Get it done. Now, the question is, like you said, it doesn't happen on the treadmill and it happens outside. So the next question is, what are you doing differently when you're running?
Going on any kind of windy path makes it even more difficult for me to complete a run without.
Okay, so you're turning around. So what happens if you go on a straight line back and forth?
Well, I mostly run on a bike path, which is pretty straight. Mm-hmm. So
does it happen when you run on a straight path? I mean, that's the next question. Is that what happens when you run?
It still will happen to me if I haven't run outside long enough. Or it could be making it up, but when it seems particularly humid.
Uh huh.
it seems to happen, or, you know, another time it seems to happen almost always is like if just after it's rained and the sun is shining down and like the, you know, bouncing off the, like the puddles or the, you know, that seems to make it worse.
I think, if I were to put this all together, I think this is a vagal nerve overstimulation. I think there's a psychological component to it that you have learned. Just like some people, as I say, vomit or get faint when they see blood. What has happened is over time, because you've had this overstimulation intermittently, you've then learned that certain things key it, and then you actually, this can be in your subconscious, you actually then affect your vagal nerve. You then get the feedback of your pulse starts to slow and you feel nauseous, and then you know you've got your syndrome, so you've got to stop, vomit, and the thing goes on, because your vagal nerve is under, to some extent, under psychological control. And that's what I think is happening. Now, the next question is, can you get yourself out of doing this? Well, I don't know what the answer is, but just like people can be desensitized to phobias that they have, it may be that the same psychological treatment that they use for phobias, you can do for running. In other words, it may be that a clinical psychologist or a sports psychologist is the person you go to. So my two recommendations are get a tilt table test to find out if there's something actually going on of a cardiac nature. You'd like to know that. And if that isn't the case, read about vagal nerve and stimulation and see whether or not that education will help you. And if that fails, go to a sports psychologist or someone who specializes in phobias and see whether or not you can unlearn what I think you have learned to stimulate that vagal nerve. That's my pronouncement. Where's my gavel when I need it? Bang. There it is. Johns Hopkins 0, Zorba Pastor 1. And let us know what happens. Please, this is very interesting.
I sure will. Thank you so much.
Sure, we appreciate
it. You're welcome.
You aren't going to believe this. Maybe you will. Talking about this tilt table thing and her getting dizzy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's getting me a little dizzy. I'm not kidding you. You were talking about power of suggestion.
Well, that's what it is. You can then think about it and then become dizzy. So you really are dizzy.
A little bit.
Yeah. Well, no, but that's what I mean. So it's the power of suggestion. She may have learned this behavior, although it's actually occurred. And the vagal nerve is open to conscious and subconscious stimulation.
Yeah. But you're never going to get me on one of those tilt tables.
No, I'm not going to even try, Tom. I am not going to even try.
Time now, once again, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today from Dana, who wants to buy a juicer but needs your advice first. She writes, I've heard that juicers pulverize fruits and vegetables so much that it actually renders the nutrients useless for the body. Is this really true?
That is absolutely false. They do not pulverize them so the nutrients are useful. Now, they do change some of the things. They change the fiber, so you remove fiber when you're actually juicing it. But vitamins are really not pulverized. I don't think there's any evidence that they're actually pulverized when you're doing it for the juicer. I've never read anything that shows the vitamins are pulverized. So I would call that a myth. And I think that juices are wonderful. Once again, the real issue with juices is to make sure that you're juicing some fruits and vegetables, because fruits are high in calories and veggies are not.
Think your myth can survive the juicer? Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number, you know, is 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, we have a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Number of diabetic-type questions. On the juicer just brought up, I was told that I should be eating the fruit and not the juice because of the lack of fiber, and the fiber helps to make it so that the sugar isn't taken in so quick.
You got it. That's always the case. Or if you're having juice and it's a sweet juice, have a juice glass of it, which is 6 ounces, not the typical Wisconsin juice glass, which is 24 ounces.
Next liquid question is, I'm getting ready to hit my busy season on the road to conventions, and I drink a lot on the road, and used to go with McDonald's sweet tea kind of stuff, but I've got to be switching to my liquids. Are diet sodas better for me than regular soda.
I mean, regular soda is a great way to deliver wasted calories into your body. Now, some research will say no calorie is wasted, but if you don't need the calories, they're wasted calories, period. In other words, when we eat too much so we become fat, by definition, the calories are wasted because they're actually dangerous calories because they're putting us at risk. Diet soda, you don't have the calories. Well, then you have the people on the other side that say diet soda is bad for us because it has artificial sweeteners. That is true. They do have artificial sweeteners. And so for people who are worried about the artificial sweeteners on one side and worried about the calories of soda on the other side, my recommendation is club soda. Club soda has, or seltzer, has absolutely no calories. And then you can buy a variety of different things that are now marketed where you squirt some flavoring into the club soda, and it's still fewer calories than you would get with regular soda. So you pick and choose. You know, I don't drink myself artificial drinks because I don't care about sweet drinks that much. And if I'm going to have a Coke, rum and Coke, which I'll have a real Coke because that's what I want to have. But I don't drink soda, so I don't worry about this. But there's some people who I think sit around worry about artificial sweeteners, and I don't think there's much to worry about here. I think it's an opinionated issue that people should do what they want to do. That. Give an answer to that. There's no scientific evidence that artificial sweeteners are bad, but there is scientific evidence that lots of wasted calories are bad for us.
Thank you.
Yep. You're welcome.
Thank you for the call. And before we head out, Zorba, time for a word from your favorite crew, the Grammar Police.
Oh, I love them. Go, Grammar, go. They, you know what? They need to have a cheer. That's what they need to have.
This week, Gary in Iron River, Wisconsin, has a problem with your pronunciation of a certain Italian cheese. He writes, Tom and Zorba, during a recipe discussion, Zorba mentioned mascarpone cheese.
Uh-huh. That's the way I've always pronounced it.
Spelling,
how is it pronounced?
The spelling is actually mascarpone, and according to Wikipedia, is pronounced mascarpone.
Oh, right.
Or mascarpone in Italian.
Mascarpone cheese.
Gabrielle, he did better than I did. Move the R to where it belongs.
I shall.
Well, if you've taken issue with Zorba's R's, send your complaints along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us, you can like us, you can fan us on Facebook.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime, too, at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0511Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.